Hi, I'm Pike Malinowski, the producer of the East Village Poetry Walk. Just want to let you know a few things before we get started. The walk is about 2 miles long and will take an hour and a half. It's meant to be one continuous walk, but if you go slow or stop somewhere, you can always press pause. You should be able to find your way from the cues in the audio. Please pay attention to where you're going, though. Watch out for cars and bikes and other pedestrians. Kari Pitkin will be giving you directions. All the music that you'll hear is by East Villager John Zorn. Your guide for the tour is filmmaker Jim Jarmusch.
Hi, I'm Jim Jarmusch. I'm a big fan of poetry and a longtime resident of the Lower East Side. I studied poetry with Kenneth Koch at Columbia College. More about Kenneth later. And I've also had the great fortune of crossing paths with many of the amazing poets we'll be talking about today.
You should be in front of St. Mark's on the Bowery at the corner of 2nd Avenue and 10th Street. We'll be here for a couple of minutes.
For more than 60 years, there has been an intense poetry scene happening here in the East Village.
Let us go then, you and I. When the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table.
Through the 1940s and 50s, American poetry was dominated by the high modernism of T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound. But in the late 50s and 60s, poetry changed dramatically, moving toward language that was looser, less formal, more open to politics and city life, sex and popular culture, more communal. Many of those changes first took root here, in New York City's East Village. These were the stomping grounds of Allen Ginsberg and the Beats.
Maybe the East Village was the only mirror that Allen ever needed.
Of Frank O'Hara and other New York school poets.
I think most of those poets have achieved something very important. They proved that humor and the comic impulse has its place in serious poetry. That wasn't taken for granted.
Of important Puerto Rican poets and the rise of the poetry slam scene.
The purpose of slam being to fill your hungry ears with nutritious sound meaning constructs, space shots into consciousness known hereafter as poems.
We begin our poetry tour at St. Mark's on the Bowery, a cultural institution that has been central to the East Village poetry scene.
If you want more history about the church itself, pause the tape and check out the panels on the iron fence along 2nd Avenue.
For many decades, St. Mark's has had a rich connection with poetry and the arts. Houdini performed here. Isadora Duncan and Martha Graham danced here. William Carlos Williams gave a reading here. In 1966, St. Mark's became the home of the Poetry Project, a bohemian literary organization that is a premier venue for many East Village poets. Anne Waldman, one of its first directors, remembers that St. Mark's in the 60s was a fertile place for more than poetry.
I was involved with the Young Lords, a Puerto Rican nationalist group that met here. There was a Trotskyite group that met here. We had the Black Panthers had a soup kitchen, and Sam Shepard had his early plays performed here. And, you know, it's interesting that W.H. Auden was a member of the parish, of the church itself. And there's a wonderful letter, I hope still somewhere in the archive, that expresses his dismay at the new liturgy, which includes phrases like, power to the people and down with the pigs and so on. He dropped out as a parishioner, but he continued to live on St. Mark's Place.
Now walk through the gate. Walk up the three steps and go through the other gate, the one to the right of that sign that says, No Dogs Allowed. See that copper green statue on your right? Pause here for a moment.
Meet Peter Stuyvesant, governor of New Amsterdam in the mid-1600s. In his day, this area was a bowery, the Dutch word for farm. Right here on these grounds, Governor Stuyvesant put a little chapel, the foundations of St. Mark's Church. Now it's the second oldest building in Manhattan. Trinity Church downtown is the oldest. When Stuyvesant died in 1678, he was buried in the vault right here.
Now walk along the wall of the church towards the door.
They dream only of America, to be lost among the 13 million pillars of grass.
The words of a dead man are modified in the guts of the living.
I'm through with you bourgeois boys. All you ever do is go back to ancestral comforts.
He holds a key in his right hand.
I'm a victim of telephone.
You should be at the door. Open it up and go on in. Go up those stairs to the right.
In 1968, Kenneth Koch gave a poetry reading here in the sanctuary. Kenneth Koch belonged to what became known as the New York School of Poets, a group of close friends who were inspired by French surrealism and by contemporary American painters.
Are you at the top of the stairs? You have a nice view of the graveyard from the window on your left.
Koch was a professor uptown at Columbia University, but his poetry had a following in the East Village. The night of his reading, something very strange happened here. One of his students, and one of my favorite poets, Ron Padgett, was there in the audience.
Let's hang out here at the window for a couple of minutes while we listen to the story.
I was sitting in the first pew, and Kenneth was introduced, I think, by Ann Waldman. And he began to read. I think it was his first poem.
This is just a little poem I wrote when I was thinking about this reading. It's called To My Audience. My audience of camel dung and fig Newtons. My audience of hats. And how shall I address my audience of New York green frock bats?
There was a pretty good crowd that night, as I recall. Kenneth was a very popular poet, and he had a big following in the Lower East Side area among all the young poets and art lovers around here.
Are you sure there is an audience? I won't go in if there's no audience.
After a brief period, suddenly, behind him, to his left, a door opened, and a young man came through the door. Quite tall, about 6'3", wearing a kind of a ragged, beat-up Dostoevskian overcoat, and with kind of a crazed look on his face. And as he approached Kenneth, he extended his right arm.
Morpheus sleeps. Mercury or Murphy...
and fired several shots at Kenneth.
That was a benefit shooting.
All I know is I got a big adrenaline rush, and it was followed by a huge rush of relief when I saw that Kenneth had not, in fact, been shot. And he immediately dug himself out verbally.
Well, now, I don't want the congregation to get upset by these hijinks. These young people have a very fine cause that they're working for, and
the, quote, shooter was actually an anarchist and radical poet named Alan Van Newkirk, while from the back, a colleague of his was handing out some kind of printed leaflets, radical publications under the imprint of Guerrilla.
Guerrilla.
I learned later that the colleague of the shooter in the back was a poet, a fairly recent Romanian emigre named Andrei Codrescu. He had a Transylvanian accent, so it was compelling.
Well, I emigrated from Transylvania to Detroit. I didn't speak any English, and so when I got to Detroit, I fell in with a group of writers against the Vietnam War, and one of them was Alan Van Newkirk.
Van Newkirk was a little bit more elusive and fugitive kind of guy who had a kind of a reputation for being scary.
It was set up so that Alan would go up to Kenneth with a fake pistol and shout death to bourgeois poetry, and then the two or three of us were going to throw newspapers in the air, and then the people would, of course, pick them up and read our manifestos and go ahead and commit world revolution. Except it didn't quite work out that way.
So why don't you stop interrupting the reading? Scram.
I was just sort of following the party line of Alan Van Newkirk, who sort of declared Kenneth a bourgeois poet at that time. But then, of course, when I read Kenneth's poems, I felt a lot more kinship to Kenneth's poetry than I did to that of Alan, you know. So if there was a choice between shooting somebody, I think Alan would have been the more likely candidate for me.
Get out. Grow up. revolution.
And Kenneth went ahead and just picked up with the poem and read it absolutely marvelously, as if nothing had happened. And I put that together with the fact that Kenneth had been a rifleman serving in the American Army in the Second World War in the Philippines, and he actually saw combat there where real people were shooting at him and really trying to kill him. So I guess he was a little bit more used to the sound of gunfire and the idea of being shot than most of us were.
I never should have said my audience of camel dung, I guess. Well...
Let's go back outside again.
Kenneth Koch went on to be a famous poet. Andrei Kudrescu went on to become a famous commentator on NPR. But whatever happened to Alan Van Newkirk, the would-be assassin? Well, here's the latest. In 2005, Van Newkirk robbed a Toys R Us outside Detroit. After a car chase and some gunplay, he was shot by police.
You should be outside in the churchyard. We'll be here for a few minutes.
Several literary tribes read their poetry here at St. Mark's. There were the Beats, Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac, William Burroughs, and other self-styled bohemians whose lifestyle caught the attention of the press, as in this WNYC documentary.
Sometimes it is said that many of the so-called Beats in the village take marijuana. A possible explanation for this is linked to the mushroom clouds that hover over all of humanity.
And there was another powerful tribe, the New York School poets, John Ashbery, Kenneth Koch, Frank O'Hara, James Schuyler, and others. They were prone to sophisticated silliness, but as poet and critic David Lehman says, this silliness was part of an agenda.
I think the big sin for New York School poets was always the idea of the pompous, the pretentious, the world-weary, the idea that the poet was an agonizing figure, that writing poetry was an act that was like opening a vein and bleeding.
The attack on pomposity was spearheaded by Frank O'Hara. Here he is reading an excerpt from Ode to Joy.
We shall have everything we want, and there'll be no more dying on the pretty plains or in the supper clubs. For our symbol will acknowledge vulgar materialistic laughter over an insatiable sexual appetite. And the streets will be filled with racing forms, and the photographs of murderers and narcissists and movie stars will swell from the walls and books alive in steaming rooms to press against our burning flesh, not once but interminably. As
water flows. The New York School poets tended toward irony and camp, but the Beats were rhapsodic. They thought of themselves as the modern-day heirs of mystical poets like William Blake, Arthur Rimbaud, and Walt Whitman. But both schools thought poetry, above all, should be alive, immediate, and fun.
Now go to the back of the churchyard, to the right of the door we went in earlier. Do you see those plaques on the wall there?
Paul Blackburn, Frank O'Hara, W. H. Auden, Michael Skolnick, all poets associated with the East Village at some point in their careers, are celebrated here with memorial trees planted in their honor.
Go on out the back gate. Now take a right and head toward 2nd Avenue and stop at the corner.
One of the trees planted in St. Mark's is dedicated to Ted Berrigan.
Dear Margie, hello. It's 5:15 a.m. Buck till 7, now she's late to work. And I'm 18, so why are my hands shaking? I should know better.
Berrigan was a hugely influential poet and an East Village fixture in the 60s and 70s. Berrigan is probably best known for his sonnets, not rhymed A-B-A-B Shakespearean sonnets, but like Shakespeare's, they were written to a muse. Berrigan said his muse was the East Village and all his poet friends.
You should be at the corner of 2nd Avenue and 11th Street. As you listen to the next poem, take a left and walk up 2nd Avenue one block to 12th Street.
In the sonnet you're about to hear, Berrigan casually mixes up the names of his own poet friends with the names of literary greats as he describes his thoughts on an ordinary day here in the East Village.
I wake up back aching from soft bed, Pat gone to class, Ron to work. I never heard a sound, it's my birthday. I put on birthday pants, birthday shirt, go to Adams, buy a Pepsi for breakfast, come home, drink it, take a pill, I'm high. I do 3 Greek lessons to make up for cutting class. I read birthday book from Joe on Juan Gris, real name Jose Victoriano Gonzalez. Stop in the middle, read all my poems, gloat a little over new ballad, quickly skip old sonnets, imitations of Shakespeare. Back to books. I read poems by Auden, Spencer, Pound, Stevens, and Frank O'Hara. I hate books. I wonder if Jan or Helen or Babe ever think about me. I wonder if David Bearden still dislikes me. I wonder if people talk about me secretly. I wonder if I'm too old. I wonder if I'm fooling myself about pills. I wonder what's in the icebox. I wonder if Ron or Pat bought any toilet paper this morning.
You should be on the southwest corner of 2nd Avenue and 12th Street. Cross 2nd Avenue and keep walking east toward 1st Avenue.
Daniel Kane is a poet and critic who has written about Berrigan and the East Village poetry community.
Berrigan takes these very recent literary traditions that are all around him, literally all around him. Charles Olson was on 9th Street, Frank O'Hara's living right near Tompkins Square Park. And he takes all these various strands, the high aestheticism of the New York school, the down and out tendencies of the Beat school, and he like collages them together. He synthesizes them at the same time as he's committed to this great lyricism. I mean, there are moments in the sonnets that take your breath away, of just in terms of their sheer lyric beauty.
Ted Berrigan was part of what later became known as the Tulsa Gang, along with his poet friends Ron Padgett, Joe Brainard, and Dick Gallup. They all came to the East Village from Tulsa, Oklahoma, where they had originally met. David Lehman.
Berrigan was doing a master's degree in Tulsa, and he met Ron Padgett in a bookstore and must have had a galvanizing influence on young Ron Padgett, who's still in high school.
The Tulsa Gang formed the core of the second-generation New York school. They absorbed the playful, casual language of the first generation into their own very individual idioms, which are still influencing younger poets today. Ron Padgett has been living here in the East Village since 1960, just one block away on 13th Street.
As you listen to the next poem, just continue walking down 12th Street toward 1st Avenue.
Here's Ron Padgett reading Poema del City.
I live in the city. It's a tough life, often unpleasant, sometimes downright awful. But it has what we call its compensations. To kill a roach, for example, is to my mind not pleasant. But it does develop one's reflexes. Wham! And that's that. Sometimes, though, the battered roach will haul itself onto broken legs and, wildly waving its bent antennae, stagger off into the darkness to warn the others who live in the shadow of the great waterfall in their little teepees. Behind them rise the gleaming brown and blue mass of the Grand Tetons, topped with white snow that blushes come dawn and glows come dusk. Silent gray wisps rise from the smoldering campfires.
You should be getting close to 1st Avenue. When you get there, cross and continue east on 12th Street.
You might recognize this. It's Don Giovanni. Mozart wrote the music, but the guy who wrote the libretto was once buried a little further down the street. His name was Lorenzo da Ponte. You could say that, spiritually speaking, da Ponte was the first East Village poet.
There will be a garden and a basketball court coming up on your right after you've crossed 1st Avenue.
This is where a Catholic cemetery once was, where da Ponte was buried until they moved his remains. The story goes that when developers wanted to build on the cemetery grounds, a priest cursed them. "Nothing will stand on these grounds," he said. "Every attempt to build something here has failed, as you can see from the open lot."
Let's stay here at the open lot for a minute, where the greatest librettist of all time was buried.
Before coming to New York, De Ponte led a raucous life in his native Italy, having many erotic misadventures with high-born women and getting into political trouble with the authorities. In Vienna, he met Mozart and wrote the libretto for three of his operas. In 1805, running from creditors, he left Europe and moved to New York City, where he got a job in his father-in-law's grocery store. Late in his life, Lorenzo De Ponte worked to bring Italian opera to New York. While he died in obscurity in the 1830s, a decade later, opera would become wildly popular in the city.
Keep walking down 12th Street. Stop when you get to the Mary Help of Christians Catholic Church, a cream-colored building on your right, just past the public school.
One of the most ardent opera fans in the city was a young journalist by the name of Walt Whitman. As Whitman scholar Joanne Krieg says, bel canto opera had a profound effect on Whitman's revolutionary free verse.
The bel canto opera features a very long line of vocal music. And then, of course, you look at Whitman's poetry. And what does it have? Very long lines.
You can hear that operatic long line in his poem, To a Stranger. Passing stranger, you do not know how longingly I look upon you. You must be he
I was seeking, or she I was seeking. It comes to me as of a dream.
It comes to me as of a dream. I have somewhere surely lived a life of joy with you. All is recalled as we flit by each other, fluid, affectionate,
chaste, matured. You grew up with me, were a boy with me, or a girl with me. I ate with you and slept with you. Your body has become not yours only, nor left my body mine only.
You give me the pleasures of your eyes, face, flesh, as we pass. You take of my beard, breast, hands, in return.
I am not to speak to you, I am to think of you when I sit alone or wake at night alone.
I am to wait.
I do not doubt I am to meet you again. I am to see to it that I do not lose you.
Let's take a seat on the steps of the church. We'll be here for about 5 minutes.
Some people call Walt Whitman the grandfather of American poetry. His most direct literary descendant was probably Allen Ginsberg, who adopted Whitman's long free verse line and shared his love for New York City. Ginsberg lived in a number of buildings in the East Village, but the apartment he lived in the longest is across the street. It's 437 East 12th Street.
The East Village really was Allen's permanent home.
That's poet Bob Rosenthal, Ginsberg's friend and his secretary for the last 20 years of his life.
If you look up at the apartment building there, Ginsberg lived on the fourth floor.
The first time you come to visit Allen, you would have to yell up from the street, and he would open the big wide center window and throw down the key, always embedded inside a unmatched used sock.
Scores of poets fetched the key out of that sock. They would come knocking on this door, and Ginsberg, the master of ceremonies, held forth.
America, I've given you all, and now I'm nothing. America, $2.27, January 17th, 1956.
The East Village gave him freedom to be who he wanted to be gay, to be political, to be on drugs, to be whatever. It was cheap, and Allen was a very frugal person. He did not need the trappings of a nice apartment. He really lived in dumps. There was very little privacy, but Allen wasn't looking for privacy. Maybe the East Village was the only mirror that Allen ever needed.
In the mid-70s, when Allen Ginsberg moved into this building, this was a rough block, Italian gangs at one end and Puerto Rican gangs at the other.
A popular sport was to steal cars, bring them to the block, strip them down in a couple hours, then on a summer's evening, fill them with garbage, set them on fire, and people would sit down on the steps of the church and cheer as the fire trucks lazily rolled down to put out the fire. Then, after Saturday night, fumes would slowly evaporate. At 6 o'clock on Sunday morning, Mr. Bongiorno, a man who lived at 437 East 12th Street, would walk out the door, walk over to the church. He was the bell ringer. He would ring one side, and you could pace out his steps to the other side and then ring the other bell, and life would start a new day.
In the 1980s, something new appeared in the East Village, gentrification.
In the early 90s, Allen must have sensed the permanence of that change, and he wrote a catalog of the people who live in his building, of the neighborhood.
That neighborhood catalog went into a poem called The Charnel Ground.
Upstairs, Jenny crashed her car and became a living corpse. Jake sold grass. The white-bearded, pot-bellied leprechaun, Silent, climbed their staircase. Ex-janitor John from Poland averted his eyes, cheeks flushed with vodka, wine, who knew what, as he left his ground floor flat.
He's remembering a time when the block really did look like a charnel ground. A charnel ground is a sacred ground in India where bodies are burned, and Allen's nature was to take reality and make it part of the sacred world. And this is what his poem does.
The Hispanic lady yelled at the rude African-American behind the post office window, "I waited all week. My welfare check you sent me notice. I was here yesterday. I want to see the supervisor. Bitch, don't insult me refusing to look in."
Allen had a very deep personality that could see deeply into people. Even though Allen would say no more than hi, he would be saying hi to the little Buddha deep within the person on the street, and they would never forget it.
"And I'm on my way uptown to get a CAT scan, liver biopsy, visit the cardiologist, account for high blood pressure, kidney stones, diabetes, misty eyes, and dysesthesia, feeling lack in foot soles, inside ankles, small of back, phallus head, anus. Old age, sickness, death again, come round in the wink of an eye."
Okay, let's get up. Keep walking east on 12th Street. When you get to Avenue A, cross over and continue on 12th Street all the way over to Avenue B. Watch out for cars, bikes, and motorcycles when you cross the street.
Allen Ginsberg became famous as a poet in the 1950s when he wrote Howl, an attack on cultural conformity as well as on literary formalism. But Ginsberg became even more famous as a counterculture hero of the 1960s. Conformity and cookie-cutter suburbs were out. Ginsberg embodied the new spirit of radical politics and spiritual experimentation. College students hung pictures of Ginsberg on the wall. His poetry and the poetry of other beats became part of pop culture. And even radical poetry could be popular, as proved by one ambitious project. In 1969, long before answering machines, voicemail, and instant messaging, the poet John Giorno recorded a bunch of poets, hooked up 10 tape machines to 10 telephone lines, and every time people called, they got to hear a poem.
Motorcycles, boom, boom, boom. Motorcycles, boom, boom, boom. Crash, crash.
This is the East Village poet and actor extraordinaire, Taylor Mead, reading his poem, Motorcycles, for the Dial-A-Poem Project.
"I don't know where I'm at. What municipality, unreality, rebop, ubop, shebop, sleebop, ubop, crew cut, hailstorm, reform, imagine in uniform, chloroform, fifth form boys in gymnasium clothes, and Aunt Martha in a bra, singing rah, rah, rah in the raw, aha. What municipality, unreality, Sigmund Freud, Constant Lambert, Vespa, Volkswagen, cemented, paved, demented, raved, caved. Hello, young lovers, wherever you was. Come, 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 all over each other.
Dial-up home was incredibly popular. In the first 5 months, 1,112,337 calls were received. Scholastic Magazine even did an article on the project, and suddenly dialing a poem was homework in some New York City schools. But not all of the poems were appropriate for school kids. Take this poem by Bernadette Mayer, who was involved for years in the East Village poetry scene. It's called Sonnet, and she uses some pretty harsh language, just like the ancient Roman poet Catullus that Mayer later translated.
You jerk, you didn't call me up. I haven't seen you in so long, you probably have a fucking tan. And besides that, instead of making love tonight, you're drinking your parents to the airport. I'm through with you bourgeois boys. All you ever do is go back to ancestral comforts only money can get. Even Catullus was rich, but nowadays you guys settle for a couch by a soporific color cable TV set instead of any arc of love. No wonder the G.I. Joe team blows it every other time. Wake up, it's the middle of the night. You can either make love or die at the hands of the Cobra Commander. To make love, turn to page 32. To die, turn to page 110.
Explicit language was just one category of subversion on the dial-up poem tapes. There was also this.
There are those who can tell you how to make Molotov cocktails, flamethrowers, bombs, whatever you might be needing.
Diane de Prima reading from Revolutionary Letters, actual instructions on how to prepare for the coming revolution.
Define your aim clearly. Choose your ammo with that in mind.
Her text shows how some East Village poets blurred boundaries between poetry, leftist politics, and Eastern spirituality.
If you haven't already, cross Avenue B and look for PS61 on your right. Watch out for cars. They come in both directions here.
The Board of Ed received complaints about dial-up home. John Giorno hired lawyers and actually won the legal battle. But he lost funding, and the reels of poetry stopped turning. Today, most of the recordings have found a permanent home online on the website ubuweb.com.
There's a big school building coming up on your right.
While dial-up home was supposedly corrupting New York City youth, Kenneth Koch was pioneering new ways to teach poetry to children.
Mountains, rivers, birds, and colors by Thomas Rogaski. The song is making me think of a parrot screeching while flying through the air.
In 1969, Koch taught poetry here at PS61.
Sometimes the school door is open. If it is, peek inside. It's a beautiful building.
This was an entirely new idea. An avant-garde poet, a professor from uptown, teaching school kids contemporary poetry. His student and friend Ron Padgett followed Koch into the classroom.
He had the children, for instance, write a poem in which each line begins with the word, "I wish." And he would not only just say, well, write a poem beginning where every line begins with "I wish," but he would give them examples of things that were extravagant and interesting and wild. And then he would draw examples from them orally. And the kids would get excited and start saying all these things like, "I wish my grandmother was a baboon who lived on Mars." And, "I wish a gigantic ice cream cone would fall out of the sky and crush the school."
"I wish I was a chocolate-covered flying horse. I wish the boys were pigs except my brother. I wish I was a bird so I could tell the other birds to be quiet."
Keep walking east on 12th Street now, towards Avenue C, and stop on the corner.
Koch frequently taught the poetry of his friend John Ashbery, whose work was often criticized for being too difficult and inaccessible.
John Ashbery wrote this poem, which has the name of a river in every line, which is essentially what I want you to do. I'll read you a little of it. "Far from the Rappahannock, the silent Danube moves along toward the sea. The brown and green Nile rolls slowly like the Niagara's welling descent. Wind ruffles the Hudson's surface. The Irrawaddy is overflowing."
Along with writers such as Philip Lopate and Grace Paley, Koch helped form the Teachers and Writers Collaborative, an organization that to this day sends poets into New York City public schools.
So I think that Kenneth's work was very important in opening up a whole new idea of the possibilities of poetry and children. Not only they're writing it, but eventually they're reading it as well.
That's enough to give you an idea of what a nice poem you can make out of rivers. And each line has the name of the river.
You should be at the corner of 12th Street and Avenue C.
Before the East Village became the East Village, it was known simply as part of the Lower East Side. It was predominantly Jewish, and in the 1950s, Avenue C was heavily Orthodox, though with growing numbers of Puerto Ricans.
A roadway of refuse from the teeming shores and ghettos and the Caribbean paradise into the new ghetto and new paradise.
The poet Galway Connell lived here in the 1950s.
This godforsaken avenue, bearing the initial of Christ through the haste and carelessness of the ages. The sea. Because it was a new world and I was living alone in this apartment, I felt a peculiar aloneness, which I really liked. I felt I could see things like a man from Mars could see Earth a little better than an earthling could.
Walk slowly north a block towards 13th Street. We'll be going back down in a minute.
Galway Connell celebrated Avenue C in his poem, The Avenue Bearing the Initial of Christ into the New World. The poem itself could serve as a kind of walking tour. It starts down south at Houston Street and proceeds north up Avenue C to 14th Street. Each street along the way represents one of the 14 stations of the cross. In the last two stanzas, this gigantic power plant to your right becomes a symbol of the final station of the cross, where Jesus is laid in his tomb.
Behind the power station on 14th, the held breath of light, as God is a held breath withheld, spreads the East River into which fishes leak, the brown sink or dissolve, the white float out in shoals and armadas. Even the gulls pass them up, pale, bloated socks of river water and rotted seed that swirl on the tide, punched back to the Hellgate Narrows, and on the ebb steam seaward, seeding the sea. Listen, the swish of the blood, the sirens down the blood paths of the night, bone tapping on the bone, nerve nets singing under the breath of sleep. We scattered over the lonely seaways, over the lonely deserts did we run. In dark lanes and alleys we did hide ourselves. The heart beats without windows in its night. The lungs put out the light of the world as they heave and collapse. The brain turns and rattles in its own black axle grease. In the nighttime of the blood, they are laughing and saying, "Our little lane. What a kingdom it was. Oy vey, oy vey."
Turn around and walk back down Avenue C, all the way to 7th Street.
In the 1960s and 70s, Puerto Ricans replaced Jews as the majority ethnic group in the East Village. But with gentrification, the Puerto Rican presence has declined. And now Avenue C is seeing dramatic changes, with the opening of new restaurants and bars catering to a young white crowd. In spite of the newcomers, Avenue C is still very much part of the Loisada, as the Lower East Side is called around here. Many Puerto Rican poets and artists, including poet Miguel Algarín and playwright Miguel Piñero, made the Loisada their base of operations. Piñero died in 1988, but before he died, he made his last wishes explicit in a poem. For the next couple of minutes, as we stroll down Avenue C, let's listen to Algarín reciting Piñero's poem and remembering the funeral procession that took place right here.
Just once before I die, I want to climb up on a tenement sky to dream my lungs out till I cry, then scatter my ashes through the Lower East Side.
Just keep walking slowly down Avenue C to 7th Street.
So let me sing my song tonight. Let me feel out of sight.
We began walking, spreading the ashes. And a lot of people came down into the streets and joined. And the procession was from Houston, 14th on D, from 14th to Houston on C, and so forth until 2nd. And then we came back. But towards the projects, women, old women, would fall to their knees and take the ashes and make the sign of the cross.
A thief, a junkie I've been.
To see committed every the junkies bow their heads, you know, and almost bare their freshly wounded vein, you know, to the ashes, you know. There is a very famous Puerto Rican singer who was strung out, and he was on the street that day, and he broke down and cried. And when I spread some ashes, he threw himself on top of the ashes and wept into the sidewalk, and absolutely nobody disturbed him.
This concrete tomb is my home.
I took care that every detail in the poem was taken care of.
I don't want to be buried in Puerto Rico.
That he didn't land up in Puerto Rico like his family might have wished, but that he landed up in the asphalt and concrete and beer can roses at the Lower East Side.
So please, when I die, don't take me far away. Keep me nearby. Take my ashes and scatter them throughout the Lower East Side.
In the 1970s, Algarín and Piñero co-founded the New Yorican Poets Cafe here in the East Village.
And it was at his wake that Miguel Algarín and I began talking about reopening the New Yorican, which had been closed for the 80s, the 80s being in the Lower East Side, AIDS, crack, and gentrification.
Poet Bob Holman helped bring the New Yorican back to life.
The purpose of SLAM being to fill your hungry ears with nutritious sound meaning constructs, space shots into consciousness, known hereafter as poems.
The New Yorican reopened. I imported the SLAM from Chicago, and it was there that you saw this extraordinary collision of hip-hop, SLAM, and performance poetries. And it was an extraordinary moment, and I guess gave birth to what's called the spoken word movement now.
You should be on Avenue C between 9th and 8th Street. Keep walking slowly south.
The New Yorican Poets Cafe is down on 3rd Street between Avenue C and Avenue B. It's closed during the day, but most nights they have readings and poetry slams.
Mix current events with platitudes of empowerment. Wrap it up in rhyme, or rhyme it up in rap until it sounds cool. Because somewhere in Florida, votes are still being counted. I said, somewhere in Florida, votes are still being counted.
Taylor Molly, reading at the New Yorican, where a lot of great performers got their start. Carl Hancock Rux, Sarah Jones. Check it out one evening.
Coming up on your right, between 8th and 7th, there's a mural behind the fence in the lot. See the poem written there in Spanish? In English, it translates roughly.
The idea is vapor, divine vapor, invisible and strong like the wind, that walks steadily to its immortal fate. Who dares to block its movement? If a mountain rises in its path, a tunnel opens, and through it passes thought.
We're halfway through the tour now. If you want to take a break, there's a German beer garden, Zum Schneider, a little further down on your right. When you're ready, we'll start the tour again at the corner of 7th and C. Let's go west on 7th Street now. Keep walking all the way back to Avenue B.
Allen Ginsberg lived in about 5 different apartments in the East Village over the years. One of them was on this block.
You'll see it about halfway down on the south side.
His friend Jack Kerouac used to hang out here a lot.
In my medicine cabinet, the winter fly has died of old age.
Number 206.
The one with the ochre cornice and base.
That's where Ginsberg lived. And Kerouac wrote the best part of his novel, The Subterraneans, there, although he later transplanted the novel to San Francisco. Kerouac also wrote poetry and liked to perform with jazz musicians.
Well, here I am, 2 p.m. What day is it?
Have you ever seen that famous photo of Kerouac on the fire escape? That picture was taken here.
Keep walking towards Avenue B.
The tree looks like a dog barking at heaven.
During 3 ecstatic weeks in April of 1951, high on benzedrine and coffee, Kerouac completed the first draft of a novel tentatively entitled The Beat Generation. Later, he changed it to On the Road, which, of course, became the emblematic work of The Beat Generation.
Holding up my purring cat to the moon, I sighed.
The Beats were famous for collaborating with jazz musicians, but for them, writing was a solitary act. The New York School poets were different. Inspired by French surrealists, they often collaborated on their poems. David Lehman.
The East Village is, you know, a place where a lot of people are living on top of one another. And what could be more natural than to make the writing of poetry a more social activity?
You should be at the corner of 7th Street and Avenue B. Cross Avenue B and take a right, walking up Avenue B along the park.
In Personism, a Manifesto, Frank O'Hara makes a tongue-in-cheek statement for this new literary philosophy.
Personism was founded by me after lunch with Leroy Jones on August 27th, 1959, a day in which I was in love with someone, not Roy, by the way, a blonde. I went back to work and wrote a poem for this person. While I was writing it, I was realizing that if I wanted to, I could use the telephone instead of writing the poem. And so Personism was born.
Over there on your right is St. Bridget's Church.
Take a look at the 2 modest towers on the roof. Notice something missing?
Let's hang out here opposite the church for a few minutes.
No steeples, no spires. Frank O'Hara and Bill Berkson saw them in 1960, just before they were removed.
We were walking along First Avenue when one of us spotted in the distance these 2 church spires.
Bill Berkson.
The steeples of St. Bridget's Church. One of these steeples was significantly limp, bent, curved. We thought that this steeple was hilarious. I guess it looked like a limp prick. So that was probably more Frank's perception than mine.
Frank O'Hara was gay and Bill Berkson was straight. O'Hara was in his mid-30s and Berkson was 20, a handsome young man from the Upper East Side. Soon after they met, Bill became Frank's new muse and collaborator.
Song heard around St. Bridget's. When you're in love, the whole world's Polish, and your heart's in a gold-stripped frame. You only eat cabbage and yogurt, and when you don't sign your own name.
At the kitchen table in O'Hara's apartment on the other side of the park, O'Hara and Berkson started collaborating on a poem about St. Bridget's and its limp steeple.
We took turns at the typewriter. While he was writing, I was wandering around the apartment, usually poking into his bookcase, searching for some sort of inspiration that would help me keep up. So Frank would go rat-a-tat-tat, and then I would sit down and go rat-ta-ta-ta-tat. When you're shaving, your face is a snowbank, and your eyes are particularly blue, and your feelings may be fading and go blank, but the soap is happy it's you. We were in love with each other in a certain way, and it was just a question of how that was going to be demonstrated. I mean, we could have, like, as happened with Frank and many, many, so to speak, straight guys, gone to bed one night and just done that. And in a way, I sort of regret not having. Why not? You know, well, I was sort of stiff about it. You know, but in another way, I think he understood that if that got really to be the point of the relationship, that it wouldn't be very good for that relationship.
Walk north on Avenue B.
When you're in love, the whole world's a steeple, and the moss is peculiarly green. You may not be liked or like people, but you know your love's on your team.
See the tall apartment building across the street? That's the Christadora House, the tallest building in the East Village. Iggy Pop used to live there. Two doors further down was where jazz great Charlie Parker used to live. Now start walking west through the park at 9th Street, straight on over to Avenue A. We'll see you on the other side.
Now we're going to hear a poem by a friend of Frank O'Hara. John Ashbery was never part of the East Village poetry scene per se, but his poetry has profoundly influenced virtually all of the poets associated with the East Village, and he is now one of the most highly regarded poets in the world. But it wasn't always so, says David Lehman.
It's hard to remember this because Ashbery is now so widely accepted and admired. But there was a time when no one had heard of this poet, when he was considered the farthest extreme of a kind of avant-garde poetics that was forbidding in the way that Schoenberg's music might be forbidding to someone who's addicted to melody.
Ashbery's poetry mixes high and low culture, French surrealism blended with TV shows and nursery rhymes. His poems meander seemingly at random from one thought to another. Here's an Ashbery poem to meander with as you walk through Tompkins Square Park. It's called Just Walking Around.
What name do I have for you? Certainly there is no name for you, in the sense that the stars have names that somehow fit them. Just walking around, an object of curiosity to some, but you are too preoccupied by the secret smudge in the back of your soul to say much and wander around, smiling to yourself and others. It gets to be kind of lonely, but at the same time off-putting, counterproductive, as you realize once again that the longest way is the most efficient way, the one that looped among islands. And you always seemed to be traveling in a circle. And now that the end is near, the The segments of the trip swing open like an orange. There is light in there and mystery and food. Come see it. Come not for me, but it. But if I am still there, grant that we may see each other.
John Ashbery, reading his poem, Just Walking Around.
If you're not there already, walk towards Avenue A. You should be just outside the park where 9th Street meets Avenue A. Cross over Avenue A and walk onto the south side of 9th Street. You see that bus stop over there on the north side? Pause when you're right across from it. Are you there? Look over on the other side of the street. Just left of the bus stop is number 441. See the apartment right above the shop, just left of the bus stop sign?
Here's where Frank O'Hara lived at the time he collaborated with Bill Berkson. In New York, there are a lot of plaques on buildings where famous artists lived. There really ought to be a plaque on this apartment. A series of very interesting poets lived here. When O'Hara moved out, Joe Brainard moved in.
I remember many first days of school and that empty feeling. I remember the clock from 3 to 3:30.
Like Ron Padgett and Ted Berrigan, Joe Brainard came from Tulsa, Oklahoma. He was a poet, a painter, and a cartoonist. His most famous piece of writing is the book I Remember, a collection of little poetic memory fragments that all start with the words, I remember.
I remember when girls wore cardigan sweaters on backwards. I remember thin gold chains with one little pearl hanging from them. I remember ponytails.
Ron Padgett.
Joe had a kind of naive sophistication or a sophisticated naivete that enabled him to do the simplest thing and have it come out to be revelatory.
I remember Ron Padgett in high school. He had terrible acne and hardly ever smiled. He wore mostly blue jeans and plaid flannel shirts. He drove a red MG. His father was a famous bootlegger in Tulsa, and everyone knew it. One year, he was president of the literary club. I remember daydreams of saving someone from drowning and being a hero. I remember daydreams of going blind and how sorry everyone would feel for me. I remember one very cold and black night on the beach alone with Frank O'Hara. He ran into the ocean naked, and it scared me to death.
Walk back to Avenue A and take a right. Then walk down Avenue A and take a right on St. Mark's.
In the 1960s, the underground press and small literary magazines thrived in the East Village.
I always published mimeographed leaflets. I had a bookstore for a long time that was one of the first community print centers in the country.
A couple of blocks from here, the poet Ed Sanders ran the Peace Eye Bookstore.
Take a right on St. Mark's.
It was one part bookstore, one part crash pad, one part publishing house.
It'll just let anybody come in off the streets and print something. I would print anything, all the street leaflets and flyers and little books of poetry. Anybody could use my equipment. So it was in my blood.
In 1966, Sanders was arrested on obscenity charges for publishing a journal whose very name no doubt attracted the attention of the authorities. It was called Fuck You, a Magazine of the Arts.
Keep walking on St. Mark's toward First Avenue. Our next stop is about two-thirds down the block at Café Mogador.
In spite of legal and financial problems, the underground press in the East Village thrived, thanks in part to a new cheap technology, the mimeograph machine. Daniel Kane is the author of All Poets Welcome, the Lower East Side Poetry Scene of the 1960s.
You're a writer in the Lower East Side, and once, twice, or even three times a week, you're reading your poems out loud in these cafes, and you're sending your poems out to the Kenyon Review, and they keep on rejecting it. So what do? You publish yourself, and you do it very, very quickly, thanks to the technology of this machine called the mimeograph. You invite your friends over to your house, you collate all the pages, and you staple it. And at the end of the evening, you have a journal, and your poems are in it, and you're published. And you go to Ed Sanders' Peace bookstore, and they take it, and they say, thanks very much. And before you know it, the most innovative writers in New York are reading your work, and you're becoming part of their world. You don't have to wait 6 months or a year to see your name in print. In some cases, you literally see your name in print the next day.
Café Mogador is coming up on your right. Stop when you get there.
Once you met them, then you would go over to their house at 101 St. Mark's Place and just kind of hang out.
That's Eileen Miles, who cut her teeth as a poet in the East Village, where she still lives. She recalls the scene in the apartment of poets Ted Berrigan and Alice Notley.
I'll never forget the night that I went to visit them. I remember, like, I had, you know, some pills and some beers and, you know, in my bag and stuff and some poems. And I just walked around the block and around the block and around the block. I was scared. It was like the date of a lifetime.
In the Berrigan-Notley household, poets came and went at all hours of the day.
See the entrance there in the middle of Café Mogador? 101 St. Mark's.
Their two sons, Edmund and Anselm, got to know a lot of them. Here's Anselm.
People would come over and talk, get advice on their life, their love, their poems, mainly their poems, and maybe bring a little money, a little food, some cigarettes for my dad, who was in not so great health at that point, and spending a lot of time in bed, sort of holding forth and talking to people.
Ted lay on his bed, and Alice sat in the front room, and you'd have a conversation with Alice, and Ted would keep yelling things out from the bed, you know. And then I'd hand my poem to Ted, and he would read it, and then we'd be like, hey, Alice, read this.
Like her husband, Alice Notley is also a poet. And amid all the household chaos, the voices of their children found a way into her poetry.
I invented ways to write while the house was full of people. Listening to my children, but also listening to Ted, listening to visitors, and amalgamating all the voices.
She had looked around the language and saw that there were really not very many poems for somebody in her condition. So she started writing those kinds of poems, and this is in a period where Bernadette Mayer and Anne Waldman are kind of having the same things happen. They're having kids, and they're starting to write about the responsibilities of motherhood and what that means to a self and what that means to a life. And that just wasn't part of American letters in poetry whatsoever, really.
There's one that I wrote with my sons. It's a little enigmatic. And they essentially wrote the poem, but I was the only one who understood it because it's about Ted's death and it's about who we had become at that point. The 10 best issues of comic books. 1. X-Men, number 141 and 142. 2. Defenders, number 125. 3. Phoenix, The Untold Story. 4. What If, number 31. 5. New Mutants, number 1. 6. New Mutants, number 2. 7. Micronauts, number 58. 8. Marvel Universe, number 5. 9. New Mutants, number 14. 10. Secret Wars, number 1. That's a very sad poem. It is. It's really sad. Because we are mutants. We are X-Men. We've lost one of us, and we have to change.
Anselm Berrigan and his brother Edmund also ended up in the family business. Anselm has published several books of poems, and until recently, He was the director of the poetry project at St. Mark's.
Stay on the north side of St. Mark's. Cross over First Avenue and keep walking west on St. Mark's. A couple of doors down on the other side is a Mexican restaurant called La Palapa. That's our next stop.
Edmund is also a poet and a singer-songwriter.
Once I had an earthquake, now I have none. Deep into the elevation, the sharecroppers run. While erstwhile weeping, yet keeping in tune. The others were ghosts of the harvested brood. Track the bull offenses. North and south winds rustle, beards on jaws clenched. The high ground investigates the throat singing season. The unlucky tremble.
La Palapa is at 77 St. Mark's Place. Are you there yet?
In the spring of 1917, the Soviet revolutionary Leon Trotsky worked right here in the basement offices of the newspaper Novy Mir. Several decades later, a famous English poet moved into this building. Here's Marilyn Hacker.
For me, at least, the most important poet living on the Lower East Side in the 1960s was, of course, W.H. Auden.
See that little plaque up above to the right of the restaurant windows?
Auden was considered the best English poet of his generation, witty, wry, politically committed, and socially conscious. When he relocated to New York in 1939, on the eve of World War II, he quickly became a force on the American literary scene.
I think one could make a little anthology of homages to Auden written by American poets.
His own poetry never sounded very American, or urban for that matter, except maybe one poem, which he wrote in New York after hearing that World War II had begun.
I sit in one of the dives on 52nd Street, uncertain and afraid, as the clever hopes expire of a low, dishonest decade.
After September 11th, many people saw this Auden poem as eerily prophetic. It started turning up all over the place, on websites, in emails, even on the radio. NPR's Scott Simon read it on the air.
Waves of anger and fear circulate over the bright and darkened lands of the earth, obsessing our private lives. The unmentionable odor of death offends the September night. Into this neutral air, where blind skyscrapers use their full height to proclaim the strength of collective man, each language pours its vain competitive excuse, but who can live for long in such a euphoric dream?
Let's continue west on St. Mark's.
Trotsky, by the way, didn't stay long in New York. He heard news of the Soviet Revolution and rushed back to Moscow to become leader of the Red Army.
We're going one block to see the old apartment of two other longtime East Village poets, Louis Warsh and Ann Waldman.
I'm a shouting woman. I'm a speech woman. I'm an atmosphere woman. I'm an airtight woman. I'm a flesh woman. I'm a flexible woman. I'm a high-heeled woman. I'm a high-style woman. I'm an automobile woman. I'm a mobile woman.
Ann Waldman has been a central figure in the East Village poetry scene for 40 years. Often grouped with the Beats and Allen Ginsberg, she has always emphasized the performative aspects of poetry. And, like Ginsberg, her poems are often explicitly political, as in Rogue State from 2003.
Gated communities tremble. I'm a-coming through the door. Rogue states, a state won't humble. Call her witch. Call her whore.
Anne Waldman was married for many years to the poet Lewis Warsh. In his recent poem, Eye Contact, fragments of prose come together as an impressionistic image of life in the city.
We make eye contact across the crowded room, but I'm too tired to speak.
After crossing 2nd Avenue, look for a tattoo parlor up on your right. It's called Flesh Center.
I write her a letter, but at the last minute, decide not to mail it. She writes in her diary how much she hates me. I shouldn't have read it. The Trojan War was a play put on for the pleasure of the gods. Deficient kidneys are often due to excessive loss of semen. Economic growth is promoted at a direct expense of human health. I saw you walking towards me from a distance, but I lowered my eyes when we passed and you didn't say anything. You didn't say anything. A woman props her elbows on a cushion behind a screen. No one is to blame for your suffering but yourself. We were two solitaries eating alone in a crowded restaurant, staring at one another covertly above our plates. She asked me what my intentions were, and I said, "Let's be friends." Sometimes it's best to be friends with someone before falling in love. I go outside with a gun in my pocket, like a petit bourgeois. They were loading their groceries into the back of their station wagon when a guy with a ski mask came up behind them and demanded their money. We met outside Kmart and went for a coffee at Starbucks. Physical beauty and bodily health reflect good character. Friendship is a response to the tragedy of love. I can hear the sound of my voice saying something I already said. Resemblances proliferate in a swarm of analogies. I stare at the woman across from me in the subway car, but when she looks up from her book, I turn away.
Are you there?
This used to be Lewis Warsh's home when he was married to Anne Waldman.
We're at 33 St. Mark's Place, an apartment that I found in the spring of 1966.
It was about $112 at first.
Four-room, four-through apartment. Starts out here.
Railroad apartment, as they're called.
These windows out here that face the street was our living room. I used to stand at that window after staying up all night long.
Watching W.H. Auden jog by.
Then W.H. Auden would walk by carrying the London Times. He would get it on the corner.
This was a meeting place for East Village poets. It was also where they published their magazine, Angel Hair.
Well, there are now two stores at the top of the staircase. In our old apartment, there's a store called Piercing, and it's about 10 steps up from the street,
and
we can walk in.
Up there
Let's
now.
Walk
we
there.
Can walk
Let's
right
walk
in.
Go up the stairs to the tattoo parlor on the left.
And I remember once we went back to see if we could find our little, the hole in the floor where we kept our little time capsule that had a hit of acid and a Valium and a poem and a marijuana joint. And
Underneath the floorboards, this was wooden floors, and we lifted up one of the slats of wood and we hit a little bottle with some
mementos
and then little notes. And do you know whatever happened? Did we ever take it out?
No, I don't think we did, and it disappeared. I'm sure they just boarded it up. It could still be there. Maybe we can excavate.
Yeah, you heard it right. In the late 1960s, Warsh and Waldman hid that time capsule somewhere under the floorboards here. Poetry itself is a kind of time capsule, and pretty much all their energy went into it.
We were reading a lot of manuscripts for the magazine. We were editing, you know, whether it was a Jim Brody book or a Clark Coolidge book or John Wiener's, you know, you were inside their work, and that fed this, urge to keep it going.
There's also a sense that every aspect of the culture was important, not that poetry wasn't this thing on its own, but
right.
Painting and dance, music. All these things seem to connect. So there was a sense of being alive.
It's 2 a.m. at Anne and Lewis's, which is where it's at, on St. Mark's Place. Hash and angel hairs on our minds. Love is in our hearts. What else? Dope and Peter Sheldahl, who is new and valid in a blinding snowstorm.
That's Anselm Berrigan reading a poem that Dick Gallup and Ted Berrigan wrote together. It's called 80th Congress, and it starts right here in Waldman and Warsh's old apartment.
Yes, it's 1967, and we've been killing time with life. But at Lewis and Anne's, we live it up. Anne makes lovely snow sodas, while Lewis's whatchamacallit warms up this New Year's straight blue haze. We think about that and money. With something inside us, we float up to and onto you. You were truly there, and now you're here.
Let's leave the flesh center.
Stephanie said,
keep walking west on St. Mark's toward 3rd Avenue.
She wants to know why she's given half her life.
Walk down to the end of the block and take a left at 3rd Avenue, which is called Cooper Square on the signs.
Stephanie says,
Stephanie says,
when answering the phone,
answering the phone.
A little further up on your right is a brick building with creamy white storefronts.
Now it's restaurants and retail, but this building used to be a Polish recreation center called the Dom. In April of 1966, Andy Warhol first presented the Velvet Underground here.
Alaska, between worlds, so the people ask her, 'cause it's all in her mind.
Keep walking west.
It's all in her mind.
It was an era when the boundaries between art and pop culture were breaking down. Once again, literary historian Daniel Kane.
It seems like there is a period of time when poetry is associated very clearly with fun. I guess I do have this kind of very romanticized view of what it was like to live in this city when you didn't have to work 5 days a week and when you could afford to be with your friends and meet your heroes and see the Velvet Underground, you know, and go to St. Mark's Poetry Project.
But doesn't hang up the phone. What seashell sea is calling from across the world? But she's not afraid to die.
Walk down to the end of the block and take a left at 3rd Avenue, which is called Cooper Square on the signs. Across the street in front of you is Cooper Union. Now it's a school of design and engineering, but 150 years ago, the Great Hall was the largest public venue in Manhattan.
On February 27, 1860, Abraham Lincoln gave an anti-slavery speech at Cooper Union. This was Lincoln's first appearance in New York, a large, ungainly man from out west whose pants didn't quite reach his ankles. His oratory was more impressive than his appearance.
Walk south on 3rd Avenue, past Ray's Pizza. We're headed toward the Bowery.
His speech was a hit and helped launch him as a viable presidential candidate. While on the road, the famously melancholic Lincoln often read poetry in bed before going to sleep. He also wrote poetry.
My childhood home I see again and gladden with the view. And still as memories crowd my brain, there's sadness in it too. O memory, thou midway world twixt earth and paradise, where things decayed and loved ones lost and dreamy shadows rise, and freed from all that's gross or vile, seem hallowed, pure, and bright, like scenes in some enchanted isle, all bathed in liquid light.
Just before we get down to the Bowery, take a left on 7th Street. A few doors down, maybe 100 feet away, is McSwirley's. That's where we're going.
E.E. Cummings was famous for his playful experiments with word order and how a poem looks on the page. Gertrude Stein was an early inspiration. Cummings was also a painter and experimented with cubism, both on the canvas and on the page.
Are you at McSorley's? If you want to, take a peek inside.
McSorley's is New York's oldest alehouse. You wouldn't know it from the people who frequent the bar these days, but this was once a hangout for artists. In 1923, Cummings set a poem here. Here are some excerpts from I Was Sitting in McSorley's, read by Barbara Rosenblatt.
I was sitting in McSorley's. Outside it was New York.
and beautifully snowing. Inside, snug and evil, the slobbering walls filthily push witless creases of screaming warmth. Chuck pillows are noise, funnily swallows, swallowing revolvingly, pompous, either swaddled mottle with smooth or a butt of rapidly goes gobs, the and of flex of and a chatter, sobbings intersect with which distinct discs of graceful oath upsoarings the break on ceiling flatness. The bar. And I was sitting in the din thinking, drinking the ale, which never lets you grow old, blinking at the low ceiling. My being, pleasantly, was punctuated by the always retchings of a worthless lamp. Gone darkness, it was so near to me. I ask of shadow, won't you have a drink? The eternal, perpetual question. Inside, snug and evil. I was sitting in McSorley's. It did not answer. Outside, it was New York and beautifully snowing.
Walk back outside. Hopefully it isn't beautifully snowing. Go back to the Bowery and take a left.
Bang, bang, outishly. For Monk. Boom, 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 boom.
Another poet who used to frequent McSorley's was Leroy Jones, long before he changed his name to Amiri Baraka.
Tinkle, as ifs, ands, three-toed musical afternoon dreams, midnight visions. Boom, 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 boom. These are Cape players cooking, blue glass cookers funking, edgewise questions inside the answers, chunks there, edgewise blew them near boil, funk tree landscape tinkle brood as answered questions, cardboard piano orchestras singing as if the hit parade was interplanetary. Boom, 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 boom.
Baraka lived at 27 Cooper Square.
You'll see that building on your left in a minute. You can't miss it. It's the old tenement crammed up against that tall hotel.
This part of the village is changing so rapidly these days.
I'm Hetty Jones, and I'm on the roof of 27 Cooper Square.
Baraka's ex-wife, poet and writer Hetty Jones, still lives here.
What we're looking at directly opposite used to be factories. The Village Voice used to be the Hartz Mountain Bird Food Factory. And it smelled. And the pigeons would flock to it. Oh, it was dreadful. But all of these buildings were manufacturing. No one lived there.
Until Leroy and Hetty moved in and made the house a hangout for East Village Bohemia. Poets, but also jazz musicians, who performed around the corner at the Five Spot.
Do you see number 27, there on your left? Just after the big hotel. Pause here for a moment.
An interracial couple, Hetty and Leroy were conspicuous on the streets.
There was still that horror of race mixing. So we would get stares from people, shock, hostility, catcalls.
In 1965, on the same day that Malcolm X was murdered, Leroy Jones left Hetty and their two children, moved uptown to Harlem, and helped start the Black Arts Movement. Hetty Jones is now a poet, a children's book author, a memoirist, and a community activist who refuses to be pushed out of the neighborhood she helped create. And it seems like the developers have listened to her.
The developers understand the history of the building and what went on here, and the fact that
it was worthy enough to be on walking tours of the East Village. And it honors the people who did really make the East Village. There were days when everybody who was doing anything was here.
When Hetty and Leroy first moved in here in January 1962, they brought a kitchen sink with them from their old place up on 14th Street. Here's Hetty Jones reading Ode to My Kitchen Sink.
Main man, you're my support. Your two strong legs, your back 40 years against a brick wall. Though you were old when we met, even a patch of your iron heart already showing, I thought nothing of your imperfection, only of your double virtue. One side deep, the other shallow. You've held washboards, weeks of dishes, babies, even me, ass in the deep, feet in the shallow, eyes out the window. Sometimes sink you swallow stuff like lettuce leaflets or those perfectly formed fetal broccoli florets. Maybe you need this sustenance more than that caustic cleanser, and oh, I must apologize for so continually washing out your mouth with soap when you're this perfect older city living thing I lean on. Waiting for that day, the wrecker's ball will say, enough, one life is all you to get. And given others, sink, ours has been a gift. When I wrote the kitchen sink poem, I really did feel that they were going to knock this building down. But I don't feel that way now. They've just put a whole new foundation, and when I spoke to one of the construction people about it, he said, oh, this building now is going to stand for another 100 years. So that's a nice legacy to think about.
Keep walking south on the Bowery.
A more recent Bowery poet is Brenda Kultas, who uses documentary techniques in her poetry.
I think of it as poetry in that I am more concerned with sound than I am with information, that what happens comes secondary to how it's said. But at the same time, you know, this poetry does seek to document what is seen, what's heard, you know, what takes place within that period on the Bowery. So it seeks to preserve a moment or an image.
Her book, A Handmade Museum, chronicles in minute detail a few blocks on the Bowery in the early 21st century, as the old Bowery was being transformed into condominiums. One day, when she was writing her book, Kultas set up a booth with a sign that read, Tell Me a Bowery Story.
My friend came with a video camera. Some people wanted to know if we could make them famous. Some wanted to know if their parents would see them. Some were performers and trying to give me what they thought I wanted.
This is a bit of what she heard.
He said that he grew up in Brooklyn, on the streets, as a member of the Young Skulls gang. He said, things changed for me here. This is where it changed at. There's a lot of resources around here for anybody that's on the street. Some people are so accustomed to bathhouses, soup kitchens. That's all they know. They don't feel safe inside a city shelter. They kind of feel safer in the street, on the sidewalk, or in the park. They're woken up in the morning by police at 5:30. By the time people are going to work, they don't see us. I have a gratitude for the Bowery. It's the only place I feel at peace. Only one woman stopped. She was smoking a cigarette and holding a blue shopping bag. She was very pretty, but looked too young to have a Bowery story, but she did. She had been in New York City for 10 years off and on, bartending with acting on the side. Her rent was originally $251. Now she was okay, but not where she felt she should be. She had stayed in a lot of flop houses with her boyfriend. She said, if you stay in that kind of place, rip the bedspread off. It might have bed bugs. I feel okay with the sheets. They bleach them. And never, never, ever touch the bed itself.
You should be getting close to what was once CBGB's,
at 315 Bowery, just below 2nd Street. It closed down in the fall of 2006.
CBGB's was the birthplace of so-called American punk. The Ramones, Patti Smith, the Talking Heads, and many other bands got famous here. A lot of kids on the punk scene were influenced by East Village poets.
I was really inspired by the newest ideas and approaches to writing poetry, you know. The second generation New York School is what interested me the most.
Richard Hell is a poet and musician who played with the band Television and later the Voidoids. His song Blank Generation became a kind of punk manifesto. But for Richard Hell, poetry came first.
Berrigan and Paget and the whole Frank O'Hara method of going on nerve, you know? It's like taking jazz solo or something like that, where you're in the zone and you trust your consciousness. You know, in terms of trying to keep things interesting, just like you do in conversation. But I felt frustrated by it. I wanted to speak to the whole culture. I wanted some attention. You know, writing and reading is probably my main preoccupation. But I just felt too isolated. I wanted more physical satisfaction. So out of kind of frustration with feeling doomed to irrelevance, we decided we were going to make a band.
Now cross over the Bowery at Bleecker Street, then go left and look for the Bowery Poetry Club a few doors down. This will be our last stop.
Richard Hell wasn't the only East Village poet who felt the need for the physical satisfaction of rock and roll. Patti Smith, Tom Verlaine, and many other musicians brought literary influences to their music here at CBGB's.
Whoa-ho! Look who showed up, and it's about time.
Hi, Bob. Nice to see you.
Everything, as it says over the door, is subject to change, and so spontaneity still does exist at the Bowery Poetry Club.
Don't be afraid of Bob. Go on in.
Welcome to the Bowery Poetry Club. I'm Bob Holman, the proprietor, the only word I can think of to describe my relationship to this joint. I mean, you can't be the owner because in the poetic economy, there's absolutely nothing that you can own. It's the only reason why the poetic economy is the last point of resistance against the horrific triumph of capitalism.
If there's not a reading going on, go to the back of the club and take a look above the stage to the left. See that blue and red face?
It's the daddy of the club, Walt Whitman. I remember when we first turned on Walt, it was Kenneth Koch's last reading. He was my teacher at Columbia, so it was a thrilling moment. As he approached the stage, we flipped on the light, and there was Walt. Walt Whitman, the father of U.S. poetry, and certainly the father of the Bowery Poetry Club.
The Bowery Poetry Club is the perfect spot to end our tour. It's a place where, thanks to the boundless energy of Bob Holman, the East Village poetry scene lives on. Thanks for taking this tour. It's been a pleasure.
The East Village Poetry Walk is produced by Pike Malinowski with support from the Poetry Foundation. Curtis Fox is the executive producer and editor. Emily Botine is the editorial consultant. Anne Halsey is executive producer for the Poetry Foundation. Catherine Haley is online editor for the Poetry Foundation. A number of people provided invaluable background information, help, and assistance. Daniel Kane, Anselm Berrigan, Arlo Quint, Lytle Shaw, Ron Padgett, Karen Koch, Bob Holman, Steve Cannon, Bob Rosenthal, Stacey Abramson, David Isay, Richard Hell, Larry Fagan, Julie Subrin, Julia Botero, and Marina Surkow.